Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
One of the most dynamic trends in American religion over the past 30 years has been the rapid growth of megachurches. Churches that routinely seat at least 2,000 congregants each Sunday, sometimes in multiple locations. These churches have become famous for their enormous modern buildings and campuses, the wide array of religion and non-religious services that they provide, and their charismatic leaders. The head pastors of many of these churches have become household names, such as Joel Osteen of Lakewood Church, Bill Hybels of Willow Creek, Mark Driscoll of Mars Hill, and Rick Warren of Saddleback. Indeed, Rick Warren has become such a major icon in American religion that he hosted his own presidential debate in 2008 and was then invited to give the invocation at Barack Obama's inauguration. Because of their modern and often glitzy appearance, making use of many elements of modern culture such as rock music, live internet feeds, and social media, these churches have often been accused of being superficial and appealing to the ephemeral appetites of American consumers at best, and by their more harsh critics as being nothing more than cults of personalities. Given their large size, relatively rapid growth over the past three decades, and their high visibility in the media, it is not surprising that many people consider these megachurches to be the new face of American Christianity, for better or for worse. But what is the megachurch scene really all about? And have megachurches rightfully earned the negative criticism that they have been tagged with? To explore these questions, I'm pleased to be joined today by Dave Travis. Throughout his career, Mr. Travis has served as a pastor, a denominational leader, and a consulting engineer. Currently, he is the managing director of the Leadership Network, a consulting organization that assists in helping churches innovate and expand. He has authored two books, Beyond the Box, Church Innovations That Work, co-authored with Bill Isom, and Beyond Megachurch Myths, which was written with Professor Scott Thumma and is the focus of our discussion today. We'll link to the Leadership Network as well as to Dave's books on our website, so please stop by and visit us. Dave, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Anthony.
Well, let's start with the obvious question about size, the idea of megachurches being mega. So megachurches are big, but how big are they really, and does that size vary at all?
Sure. Well, we define megachurches as large churches that have at least 2,000 in attendance on a weekend. So that could be Friday, Saturday, Sunday evening services or daytime services, because many of the churches, in fact, most of the mega churches, have multiple worship gatherings. So about half the mega churches that we studied in our book and in our follow-up research are between 2,000 and 3,000 regular attenders. And the other half are 3,000 and above.
Mm-hmm. And so how many churches are we talking about that are in your sample size there? If we had to get a rough estimation of how many mega churches there are, what would that be?
Yeah, well, we actually have a really good database of those churches. And currently we're tracking at Leadership Network about 1,517 churches of that size in the United States and Canada alone.
And you mentioned Canada as well, so it's somewhat of an international phenomena.
Well, in Canadian churches are somewhat similar to U.S. churches, but yes, it is a worldwide phenomenon happening all over the world. And even though we track a global list of those churches, mm-hmm. we're not as confident in the number that we track on that list.
Okay. Now, put this in comparison for us. What is the average size of a typical American congregation today?
Well, of course, as a scholar, you're familiar that the average and the median are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
But the typical, which I think is a good way to say it, the typical church in the United States is about 100 regular attenders on a given Sunday. So we're we're looking at churches that are 20 times the size of the typical church.
And yeah, that does have that differential skew. As some of these churches become bigger and bigger, they're starting to weight the average up. But as you say, the median tends to be, you know, around 100 or so congregants. And that's been fairly typical throughout American history. I guess, what percentage of the U.S. church-going population attends these mega churches?
Our best estimate, looking at all the data, is as far as mega churches go, about 11% of Americans attend a mega church. On the other hand, some great research was done about large churches. If you define large as 350 mm-hmm. attenders and more, about 57% of worshipers will attend a church at least of 350. So many of the hearers of today's interview will say, well, our church is a large church. I mean, that's true. Most people attend larger churches, so most churches are 100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fairly common of my experience. I actually live in a small rural town, and our church, the church that we have here, gets to be about 300 to 400 people seated every Sunday across two services. In terms of the... I have a little question here, and it relates to the style of mega churches, because a lot of times people think of televangelism when they hear this, especially when you get televised media personalities like Joel Osteen. How are mega churches different than televangelist churches or televangelism that we saw popular in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, of course, there are multiple flavors of mega churches. And in our book, we identify four different streams of mega churches, of which since that time I've slightly altered some of those definitions. However, you know, one subset of mega churches are driven by media and would have a strong media kind of TV type of presence. But that is very much in the minority of mega churches, that they would be like media driven, like some of the things that you were describing in the 1980s. Because quite frankly, most mega churches, the attendance at their largest service is under 1,000 people. And the ones you usually see on TV, you suspect that it's a mass gathering, whereas most mega churches would have services that are much more, which are much smaller than 1,000. They just have multiple services.
Yeah, so they're getting two or three services, maybe in the 400 to 500 range or so.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, I can see how that would be. Now, you addressed a number of different stereotypes in your book called Beyond Mega Church Myths, What We Can Learn from America's Largest Churches. And the first one that you deal with is whether or not mega churches are all the same. Now, you mentioned that a lot of these churches vary in size, from the baseline being 2,000 attendees or above on any given Sunday, but they can range into 5 or 10,000. So there's some variation on that size there. But I'm curious about if they vary in other ways. You've given us some hint that some of them chunk their services down into smaller groups. Others have large stadiums. What about the geography of these churches? Are they more likely to be found in some parts of the United States as compared to others?
They do tend to focus in areas that are growing areas, especially metropolitan areas that have growing suburbs. So that is the predominant or more tend to be located in those areas. However, we've had mega churches by our definition for a little over 100 years at least, in some of the major cities of the Northeast. In fact, there was a Pulitzer Prize book written a couple of years ago called The Most Famous Man in America, which was the story of essentially the Beecher family in New York at Plymouth Church, which was an early mega church by any standards. And then we've had churches throughout the United States in the early part of the 1900s that also would have fit that definition in major cities. However, having said that, our data shows that the Sun Belt tends to be the home of many or most of the megachurches of the United States. But we are finding them in almost every state.
Let me stop you there. By the Sun Belt, I'm thinking the southern reaches of the country, but there's a big difference between, let's say, a Georgia, a Mississippi, and Alabama, where most people associate the Southern Baptists as really having a strong foothold, and Arizona, which is a rapidly growing area. And that's, for me out here west, we tend to think of Arizona as the Sun Belt. So when you mean Sun Belt, are you talking all the southern states or particular ones?
No, I'm actually talking about the ring, say, from Southern California. All the way around the Southern California, Arizona, Nevada has a growing predominance of megachurches. New Mexico has megachurches. Texas, of course, is full of megachurches. And all the way up to, say, Virginia, swinging around that way. But also Illinois has a lot. Minneapolis has what I believe is the highest concentration of megachurches in the Twin Cities.
Oh, that's interesting.
Likewise, Washington State, where you are, has a growing number of megachurches. Colorado has a large number. But again, what we saw in the last two decades were the areas that were attracting lots of young families were fertile ground for the emergence of lots of megachurches. So areas that were growing in employment, in housing, these became fertile fields for the growth of megachurches.
I see that a lot here in Washington State. We're a state that has received a great deal of in-migration over the past two decades. A lot of people coming up from California, but other parts of the country as well. And in my 17, 18 years here in this state, I've seen the growth of a lot of these very, very large megachurches in the area. And it just seems that they're following the population trends or populations as they go about there.
Exactly. In fact, mobility is one of the, what I would describe as one of the enabling factors of the growth of the current era of megachurches.
What do you mean by that? Explain why mobility is an enabling factor.
Yeah, just the Americans have always been a fairly mobile society and have been, you know, many Americans are willing to move. In fact, up until a few years ago, about 26% of Americans moved at least once every 24 months. Now, sometimes that was just across town, sometimes that was across the county, but whenever a family or a person moves, many times they have to seek out all new connections. And megachurches became one of those places where they could find a safe place to connect with other people. Now, it slowed down a little bit in the recession here as some of the mobility has dropped a bit in the United States. But that was one of the enabling factors. And just like you said, Washington State has received a lot of in-migration. So there were certain regions of the country that received lots of people coming, looking for a new life, looking for a new opportunity. And those have been the places where megachurches have rapidly expanded.
The issue of mobility is a very interesting one, because I know in a number of sociological studies, the migration or people who tend to be transient, and I don't mean that in terms of a socioeconomic class, but people who tend to move around a lot, do not tend to be rooted very much in religion. They don't have deep roots in their community, which it makes them more likely to pick up and leave. And when they get to their new community, they're somewhat outcast. So it's interesting that megachurches are actually tapping into this. And I know in my own area of the country here in Washington State, we consider ourselves to be relatively unchurched. I know a number of colleagues, their eyes are popping out when these big, huge churches like Mars Hill appear. Mars Hill just built another campus off the campus of the University of Washington. And it's attracting 800, 900 students every Sunday. And we have professors here, their eyes are bugging out. They can't figure out why that's occurring.
Yeah, and I would, there's two things going on there. And one of the stories we tell in the book is about how a church planter, church starter, someone who starts a church, can look at the same ground, the same territory as other pastors, but see lots of opportunity instead of, oh, well, this place is settled, no one goes to church here. So there's one thing going on there. The other thing that's going on, and part of what we describe in the book, is the doubling of mega churches, as far as the number, in the last few years. And that is because, or I believe, that new generations of both believers and of non-believers form new institutions for new eras. And it just so happens that megachurches, a lot of them are now less than 15 years old, like Mars Hill. I can remember when Mars Hill started, to cite that example. I think it is now right at 16 years old. And it has created a new organization for, as you said, college students and now those who are up to, say, age 40, 41. I think Mark Driscoll, the lead pastor, has just turned 40 there.
Yeah, he did. We interviewed him earlier in our podcast series. We'll link to that on our website. But when he mentioned he was turning 40, I just interviewed him around his 40th birthday. That was a big shock for me because he's younger than I am. And for me, there's a demographic shift going on, is that recently my pastor at my church is younger than I am. And it's a very hard transition for me to make. Pastors were always the older gray-haired folks that you look up to for wisdom. And now I'm looking down at the other side of this thing. It's kind of interesting adjustment. I do want to talk about the growth rates of churches and how they grow in a minute here, but I also just want to finish off with some of the demographics that you talk about, because again, we're dealing with that one myth that megachurches are all the same. It's just a bland milquetoast type of religion that appeals to consumerism here. One of the other questions I have is, are these megachurches, do they have any particular denominational affiliation or theological leaning?
They tend to be, they tend to be more evangelical in orientation. However, there are some very prominent mainline megachurches. Even though our book focuses on the Protestant side of the tract, some of the same enabling factors are also going on in American Catholicism. I just read a book last week, or a galley of a book, about some of the changes in the American Catholic scene. And in reading it, there are many of the same trends that are affecting the Catholic parishes.
Yeah, what can you say about that? Because when I read through your book and I looked through the list of all these churches, and you have a breakdown by denomination on page 27 of your book, non-denominational churches are 34%. Southern Baptists make up the second biggest chunk at about 16%. And then Baptists, generic Baptists, about 10%. I didn't see any mention of Catholics here. Is there a reason that Catholics don't make that megachurch list, and is that changing?
Well, there have always been Catholic megachurches as well. It's just that the Catholic Church tends to organize themselves differently than the Protestant Church.
Right.
And they have different understandings about the role of lead pastor or priest.
Mm-hmm.
They have different understandings about what is the church in their kind of understanding. And they have different ways of measuring attendance. Most Catholic parishes measure themselves by the number of households that are registered to be a part of that parish. They don't necessarily track attendance. And so we chose to focus on the Protestant side, where Protestants tend to focus more on how many you actually got there on Sunday.
I think the same thing is true for Mormon churches, because they have a certain very specific ceiling of how many members they're going to have in each of their stakes or parishes, so to speak. And so you don't see many of those on the list. A question about that non-denominational. Again, as you measure this, you say about roughly a third of all megachurches are non-denominational. How non-denominational is non-denominational? And the reason I say that is because the two churches that I've attended over the past decade both appear to be non-denominational churches. They don't sell a denominational brand name flashing on the lights above their sign. But when you look closer at it, one of the ones was associated with the Free Methodist tradition and the other the Evangelical Methodist tradition. So are these things truly non-denominational, or are they just downplaying their denominational role?
Well, the way I tend to say it is this way. truly about a third are non-denominational. They have no existing connection with a denomination. Now, within that tribe, within that third, you do have a few. For example, we do often run into a challenge with the independent Christian tradition, which will say in a survey, we're not a part of any denomination, but many of those leaders act in a brotherhood of sorts, which tends to look like a denomination, but they will vehemently tell you, we're not a part of a denomination, it's the non-denomination denomination. So there's a subset of that third that is in that tradition. But then there's the rest that are truly not. Now, many of the lead pastors and planters of those may have come out of a denomination, and much of their theology and much of their understandings of what it means to be church was kind of formed there. But a third, really no official connection. Another third, roughly, would have a connection with an existing denomination, but just like the examples you cited, they don't want you to know about it. They tend to hide that. An example of that would be Saddleback Church in Orange County, the one you mentioned with Rick Warren. Saddleback Church, by its name, you would assume is a non-denominational church. However, it's well known that is in essence and is officially connected to the Southern Baptist denomination. And then there is another third, roughly, that are connected to a denomination and will include that in their name. Okay, so Ginghamsburg United Methodist Church in Tipp City, Ohio, is a United Methodist Church and is a large mega church. That would be an example of that third category. What is somewhat unique, or not unique, is that even though the, you know, two-thirds carry a denominational affiliation, the denomination actually means very little to their local understanding of how they do church.
Mm-hmm.
And how they operate. And they are not, for the most part, most of the megachurch pastors, at least the ones we work with at Leadership Network, are not very engaged and involved within their denomination tradition.
Let me probe this idea of denominationalism a little bit further. I'm fascinated by this and have been talking with my own pastor about it, batting around some ideas. We had Gordon Melton on about a year ago on our program, and he championed the claim that denominationalism is still going to be a force in the future, and the apparent demise of denominationalism is vastly overrated. I, on the other hand, in talking with a number of people, wonder what purpose a denomination really has in today's world with modern technology. What benefits does a denomination bring to a local congregation when you can pluck a lot of your sermon material, your vacation Bible school material off of the web, and you don't have to pay denominational fees to get all this kind of stuff? And I'm just wondering if it's easier nowadays to set up independent churches just because of the technology, and that's why we're seeing some more non-denominational affiliations here.
I would describe the emergence as not that it's easier to set up a non-denominational church,
mm-hmm.
but we do have much more freedom among young leaders who start these churches to say, I'm going to design an experience that fits my friends, not an experience that fits what they feel they've been handed down by the denomination. And so we've also seen this rapid emergence of what some scholars would call proto-denominations, or the early formation. You mentioned Mars Hill a minute ago. Mars Hill is technically not a part of denomination, but with several other churches started what's called Acts 29, which is a church planting network. And if you observe the several hundred churches that are a part of Acts 29, it's beginning to look more and more like a denomination. The same thing could be said. There was a book written in the mid-90s by a professor at University of Southern California called Reinventing American Protestantism, in which he described a couple of the new kind of church planting movement. and how they had moved from church planting movement toward something that looked like a denomination. Some now have actually become a denomination. And so we're seeing that quite a bit emerge among these mega churches, which they'll tell you they are non-denominational, but they are creating their own affiliations and networks to help not ensure theology, but to share practices and to share some resources.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably, I think denominations are going to be relevant to a certain style and size church, but they're going to be increasingly irrelevant for larger churches and mega churches.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good read of it. Now, that book, Reinventing American Protestantism, that was by Don Miller, if I'm correct,
that's
right?
Correct.
Yeah, we'll link to that on the website, too, so people can check that out. Now, when we talk about denominationalism, that usually brings to mind a specific organization. But in terms of theological outlook or the flavor of their theology, you mentioned before that these churches tend to be more evangelical. But in your book, you also classify four different types of mega churches: the old line or program-based churches, seeker churches, a charismatic pastor focus, and then new wave or re-envisioned churches. I wonder if you could give us an idea what each of those are, perhaps starting with old line program-based churches.
Yeah, sure. Old line and program-based churches were some of the early mega churches here that would have been right after, well, actually, turn of the century, the last century. These were churches that had a program for every person, and probably two or three programs for every person. They were the era of a music program for every person, a missions program for every person, and the education, whether that was Sunday school or other technology, for every person, etc. They were organized essentially as a subset of lots of groups that gathered together on Sunday or on the weekend and throughout the week. They were seven-day-a-week kind of program-based churches. The second category, the seeker category, are those that did emerge since the 1970s, which were planted by strong leaders who saw their market as people who do not attend church, or at least that's how they described it. At the time, and they were driven by the fact that we're trying to create an experience that will be comfortable for a non-church attender.
Mm-hmm.
The third category I'll point to is the charismatic leader. Our church is also that we've had for a long time that tend to be very dominantly focused on the role of the lead pastor, and in fact now the lead pastor and their spouse. And so if you were to look at an ad for that church, what you would see in the ad is usually the picture of the lead pastor and their spouse. And the final category, what we call the New Wave Re-Envision, was something we just didn't have a name for at the time. I call it now the tribal church. And these are churches that are the newest, the youngest in the phenomenon, and they tend to have a fairly concise and concentrated demographic and multiple leaders that are a part of that. And they tend to be very simple in structure and design, but they will reject the seeker label, and they will tend to have longer services than the seeker church. There's several other factors there. But those are, I can give you examples of all of those.
Yeah, actually, let's go ahead and do that. One of the questions I have, too, that you mentioned, that the New Wave churches, and when I read that in your book initially, I thought it was churches that emphasize the teachings of Duran Duran, Blondie, and a few other 80s bands, but apparently not. But you just mentioned that a lot of them reject the seeker label. And I know one of the churches when we moved out here that we started going to was considered a seeker church. And I thought that was a little bit unusual in that I said, well, this is, you know, a church, so that's where I'm, you know, if I look for Jesus, that's where Jesus shall be sought. So I didn't really quite wrap my head around that seeker type of thing. I noticed a number of churches, and that church particularly that I'd gone to, is trying to get away from that seeker label. So give us an example, let's say, of a seeker church.
Well, Saddleback, which most folks tend to have seen in one way or the other, is definitely a seeker church. And the creation myth of Saddleback, a creation story, I should say, was Rick Warren went knocking on doors and asking people, do you go to a church? If they said yes, he moved on. If they said no, he said, well, if you were to go, what would you look for? And then designed an experience to try and reach those people. Same story is told of Willow Creek. And so the design and function of a seeker church was designed to reach people who had no connection currently to a church. And it was a stage presence. It was designed for anonymity. You can come. You can watch what's going on. You'll hear some teaching. It was a non-threatening style. Whereas the New Wave Envision, or what I call the tribal church now, is very much an in-your-face, here's what God says. It's also, they have a large gathering or somewhat of a, they don't have as much of a performance culture on a Sunday, but it's also a very strong emphasis on getting you more deeply connected to Jesus and into a small group and into other systems to help disciple you and train you. And they will even say every so many months, hey, if you're not here to be serious about what God's doing in your life, maybe you should go somewhere else. Whereas the seeker church would never say that. Seeker church would say, we're ready when you're ready.
Mm-hmm. So would you consider one of the tribal churches to be, say, for instance, Mars Hill?
Yeah, Mars Hill is definitely one of the, Mars Hill is not a seeker church in my category.
Right, well, I was mentioning the tribal churches.
Yeah, it's more of the tribal church. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look, Mars Hill here again, many of your listeners would be familiar with Washington, has really decentralized its leadership and its structure away from Mark into the what they now want to call the church, local church pastors model. So you have a number of sites or campuses or what they want now call churches that are locally led, locally organized, but they do have one common treasury and eldership governing board.
Now, I would imagine that there's some blending between these different categories, because I might put something like a Saddleback, you mentioned as a seeker church, but it also seems would fit in the charismatic pastor-focused church. Is that the case?
That's definitely true. Yeah, there's degrees on all of these things. If I look at it as a... is four quadrants, and there are degrees along those quadrants. Though you'd be surprised about Saddleback as to the degree of control and authority that Rick has is more informal than formal. Whereas in a true charismatic pastor or church, and I call it the king culture, the pastor's word is the direction it's going to go. And if you don't like it, that's fine. Go find somewhere else.
Give us an example of one of those churches.
Well, I would say that there are many churches, especially in African-American Latino culture, which tend to be focused on the lead pastor. And you will hear these types of statements. If the pastor is challenged, you'll hear quotes like, don't touch God's anointed, with a scripture reference, because their understanding of church is that we follow the leader. And so here near where I live, we have a very prominent church which has a very prominent scandal here recently, New Birth Missionary Baptist Church, led by Pastor Bishop Eddie Long. And so that's an example of a king culture kind of church.
Let me, now that you mentioned African-American and Latino churches, the other question I have about the variety of these mega churches is there, ethnic makeup? I think most people have an image that these are all white bread suburban churches, but do they constitute African Americans and Latino churches?
Well, yes. Megachurches are diverse in a couple of ways. They're diverse ethnically in that there's a fairly good number of African American led megachurches. There's also a rapidly growing number of Latino megachurches. I just was a guest last week at the National Council of the Assemblies of God, and the largest attendance Assemblies of God in the United States now is in Chicago. I think it's called New Covenant Life, led by Wilfred DeJesus, which is led by Latino leadership, but is a multiracial, multiethnic kind of place there in Chicago. The second place that megachurches are diverse is that megachurches tend to be more diverse ethnically than smaller churches.
So within the church itself, not just between different churches, but within the church, there's more of a melting pot.
Melting pot may not be the right word, but okay. But yes, there does tend to be more, at least racial ethnicity difference and diversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the term might be salad bowl.
Salad bowl is probably a better description.
Yeah,
yes.
So they tend to... to be that. One question, we brought up Latinos, and I know some of my audience might be surprised by the fact that Assemblies of God and Latinos go together because they typically think of them as being Catholic. But as I know from my own research in Latin America, there's been a big, huge Pentecostal explosion in that area. And that has also been coming north of the border, as well as many Latino communities and a lot of Protestant churches are reaching out to Latino members. But what about the megachurch tendency going worldwide? Now, I know you focus mostly here on the United States and, as you mentioned, Canada, but I mean, is this megachurch phenomena a global phenomena?
Absolutely. And as you say, I'm not an expert on global Christianity. And part of the wave has come through global Pentecostalism, as the Pentecostal style of Protestantism is spread around the world now. And so we see quite a number of megachurches in Africa, Asia, Australia. I just met with several Australian megachurch pastors who were over here in the States. We have our clients here in the United States who are working with many churches in Latin America and South America, which are rapidly becoming megachurches in those areas. And you know, and that's an opportunity that we're actually looking at Leadership Network as to see how should we serve those churches, especially in our close neighbors in Latin and South America. And so it is a global phenomenon. I think part of this is driven, by the way, by rising affluence and the rising middle class in many of these countries. And as people, and this is, I'll give a slight sociological detour here. As people move up in social class, they also tend to look for new institutions to affiliate with. And in many of the cities where we see the emergence of megachurches, we see people moving from the more rural areas into the more metropolitan areas of those countries and essentially changing their identity from peasant to employee or laborer or worker. And also looking for new places to connect. And so that's one reason rising affluence has helped driving, I think, the growth of megachurches worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my favorite global megachurches is the Yeouido Full Gospel Mission in, I think it's just outside of Seoul, Korea, or it is in Seoul, Korea. It has 800,000 people attending services over a weekend, which just is, for me, that's amazing. I would just completely lose my car in that parking lot, I think. So,
yeah.
Let me talk a little bit about, you know, getting back here to the United States. Talk about the historical settings of these churches. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, mega churches really have seen a lot of remarkable growth over the past 30 years. But preaching to large crowds, that's not a new phenomena. Earlier in this podcast, we had Matthew Sutton, who talked about Amy Semple McPherson, who was able to draw large crowds to her auditorium or Hollywood-style church in Los Angeles during the Roaring Twenties. And then you had folks like the famous circuit riders of the First and Second Great Awakenings, like George Whitfield, who would attract hundreds, if not thousands, of people in these camp revivals and be standing up on a big stage and preaching to them. And then there's this other really famous preacher named Jesus, who he ministered to crowds numbering in the thousands, even fed him with only a couple loaves of bread, too. So that's kind of impressive. How does the modern megachurch fit into all this history here?
Yeah, and let's talk about the American kind of branch of that. The and like you say, that we had the revivalists in the First and Second Great Awakenings that could gather folks on an irregular basis, except many of the techniques became utilized in the cities, Finney's so-called new means, in the 1800s. And because you had large population bases in the cities and growing population bases, and here again, people moving from countryside to city, we did see the emergence of the first era, I think, of American megachurches in those places, in cities. What changed in a couple ways, we've had several technology improvements, which have enabled essentially larger structures, better sound amplification. We had in the era right after World War II, the Great Suburban Expansion, which had land and roads and the shift from people using public transportation to cars. I mean, all those are enabling factors of mega churches or these types of associational gatherings. The other thing that's happened, I'll go off track for just a minute, is that young people have, for the last couple generations, have been socialized in large high schools. The story I always tell about this is my parents graduated from high school here in Atlanta, Georgia in 1954. And their high school class, all in, about 200 people in their graduating class, they were in one of the largest high schools in Atlanta. And the graduating class was 200 at their high school. The high school was designed to be about 800 students. They also happened to attend a church that was considered one of the largest in Atlanta. And the total attendance of that church was about 800 people. It was considered large. 25 years after my parents graduated from high school here in Atlanta, I graduated from high school here in Atlanta. Not the same high school, but a suburban high school now. In my high school class, there were about 300 students in my high school graduating class. So the total school was about 1,200 kids. We attended a church that was about 1,200 people. So it was a little bit bigger than the one my parents had grown up in. That was totally normal to be in a body of 1,200, that even though it was large and still is large for its time. 30 years after that, my first child graduated from high school here in Gwinnett County, a growing suburb of Atlanta, Georgia. And her high school class would have had about 600 kids in its graduation. And the typical high school here in Gwinnett County will graduate between 600 and 700 students, meaning the whole high school is almost 3,000 students in many cases. What's changed is our definition of what's large. Yes, my children go to a large high school, but so do most students here in the Atlanta area if they go to a public high school. They go to a large public high school. And all across the country, we see this phenomenon. Young people are socialized into large high schools, and they're comfortable with large. When they have a choice to go to college, even though there are many more small colleges in the United States than large universities, most students choose to go to a large university. You're at the University of Washington, and how many undergraduates are there?
I think we have about 25,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that seems totally normal to a high school student, to move from a large high school into a large university. And one of my points of view on the emergence of the megachurch is that young people are being socialized to understand that it's okay to be in a large body, mainly because they can find their tribe within that body. Okay, so there at the University of Washington or any university, there are multiple subgroups that emerge as a part of that. But part of their identity is I'm part of the University of Washington, UW, or whatever they say out there.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. And that brings up one of the myths that you address early on in your book about megachurches being too big. And the idea behind megachurches being too big is that they become very impersonal, and that we typically have this idyllic image of small community churches back in the colonial days of only, you know, 50 or 60 people. And we have this idea that churches really should have that small community feeling to it. But again, when you start talking 2,000, 5,000, maybe even up to 10,000 people into services every Sunday, in some ways, people would say, how could you get that small community feeling? You'd be lucky if you even saw the same person over the course of a couple of months attending church there. So is this the case that churches are too big?
Well, of course, not from the point of view of a megachurch attender. And we've actually done some follow-up research since we wrote the book. It's available on our website. And the name of that particular paper is Not Who You Think They Are, The Real Stories of People Who Attend Megachurches, where we surveyed about 40,000 people who are attenders of megachurches to find out some of the factors of what gets them there, what keeps them there, etc. However, back to your original point, most of us are creatures of habit, and like I said, the average seating capacity of many megachurches, you know, when you talk about a 10,000-person megachurch, the largest room, even for a 10,000 kind of place, might be 1,000, 1,500. We're all creatures of habit. We tend to go to the same kind of area of a worship center to sit, and we get to know, really, the people around us. The other thing that megachurches have done exceedingly well is to create subgroup systems, where those are called small groups or certain classes and certain other venues, where people can connect relationally in a very strong way and to build those strong connections. It's also possible, of course, in a megachurch, just as it is in a university, if you want to go attend class, let's say at the university, and slip away and be totally hidden, you can also do that in a megachurch. And that kind of option is not available usually in a smaller church.
Right.
And so, yes, we do have in megachurches many people who come, attend, are very quiet. They may give, but they may never serve. They may never connect in any other way. But they feel their needs are being met in, say, the worship service gathering. So we have that duality there. Yes, it's easy to be hidden, but most people choose to be connected in a one of the smaller group settings or in some other way.
You know, we had an earlier podcast with Mark Vonderer, who actually talked about that there's a conscious effort to make these larger churches small. And it's not so much that the church is really centered on the Sunday service, which we typically think of most churches as being, but really getting people into the Sunday service, but then connected to a Tuesday evening Bible study group or a Wednesday horseback group, where they start out with some scriptural readings. And that's really where a lot of this church building goes on.
Yeah, we would say the community happens in those small groups.
Mm-hmm. I also like the story too, and you mentioned that we are creatures of habit and we always tend to sit in the same place. And your co-author, Scott, had mentioned that he would go, when he was researching the book, he kept going to one of these mega churches and always sat in the same spot. And I notice I do that too.
We all do.
And he was missing for a couple weeks. He was doing some other research elsewhere, whatever it might have been. And after he came, after a couple weeks, the ushers came up to him and say, "Hey, we haven't seen you here. Where have you been?" And people around him saying, "Oh, is everything okay?" Because even within a very large venue, the auditorium-style seating and stuff, you still create your little small pocket of individuals that you know. And when I read that passage, I go, yeah, I knew all the 20 or so families in my area. So,
absolutely. In fact, I've been to church staff meetings. I'm with church staff of megachurches very frequently,
mm-hmm.
and sitting in their meetings. And before either I speak or we're having the conversation they want to have with me, they're reviewing the past weekend, and one of the pastors will even say, and they're not necessarily assigned a section or assigned a particular target area, to say, you know, we haven't seen, and they'll start calling names in the last couple of weeks and, you know, writing that down for follow-up. Let's go check in with them, make sure they're okay. So even the pastors, which we tend to think of as just being platform folks and kind of disconnected, most of the megachurch leaders that I know are still very connected with the people that are even anonymous within their congregation to say, you know, I haven't seen them for a while. I need to follow up with them.
Another one of the major critiques that you address in your book, and this I think is also a very common myth that many people have about megachurches, is that they provide a watered down or lukewarm Christianity. The idea is that one's Christian faith should really be experienced with hard kneeling pads, musty hymnals, pipe organs, and a little bit of fire and brimstone. But these mega churches, though, they got rock music and theatrical plays, and sometimes they even show movies during the services. And I know many people sit there and go, how dare they? It's just a consumeristic version of that. It's kind of like a going to church at the Muppet Show or something. So is it the case that a lot of these mega churches are just more show and entertainment than they are deep theological places to go?
Well, and I'll point to, here again, the study, the follow-up study after our book called Not Who You Think They Are. When we asked megachurch attenders about their experience at the megachurch compared to the church they were a part of and compared to small churches, and megachurch attenders tend to practice their Bible reading and prayer during the week to a greater degree than people who attend small churches, they would say they are experiencing more spiritual growth in the megachurch than they did in a smaller church. They would say that they believed they had heard the gospel teaching in a clearer way than they had in their previous church. They would very strongly agree that their spiritual needs are being met to a greater degree than in smaller churches. So from the participant side, at least for those who attend mega churches, report a higher degree of satisfaction than those who attend smaller churches. I think the other thing is we survey mega churches and ask attenders, they would say that the degree that they feel that the messages, whether that's in music or word, they would feel that they are more biblical. I could not judge whether that's true or not, but they feel they are. I would also say to your point, your question, the things that people were comfortable with 50, 60 years ago, such as you described organ music and choir music, those were entertainments of a different sort and targeting a different audience. And I would contend that many of those were more or less consumer-driven. And the music delivered through the organ or through piano, and I love what has been called sacred music. I grew up with that, and I enjoy that. That is not something that I'm preaching against here. I'm just saying that was also a consumeristic response, as is the style of music that is more popular today in megachurches.
Yeah, we had a podcast with Robert Coote talking about hymns in American history, and that was one of the things that really did come out. I know many people today say, oh, that rock music, it's all, you know, strange, and we don't like it. It's not really reaching out to the gospel. They actually said the same thing about Amazing Grace in the early 1800s.
Exactly.
And in fact, Amazing Grace did not make it to be one of the most common hymns until after World War II, because people said Amazing Grace doesn't have enough Jesus in that hymn. That's one of these just crazy things. How could Amazing Grace ever make it? And yeah, I can imagine even back in medieval days when the monks started chanting, they say, oh, that stuff is never going to catch on at all. Those, I guess they wouldn't be wild-haired monks, but bald-shaven monks or something like that. kind of interesting. And you bring up, too, you know, in my experience of this, and if I, 20 years ago, had looked at a mega church. I would have probably seen a watered down Christianity too. But I, as I've experienced some of these, I've attended many of these churches, I do get the same feeling that you described in many of these places. There's a fervent in some of these places, very kind of Pentecostal feeling, even though they're not Pentecostal churches, is that you really do. And I had the opportunity to attend a Presbyterian church in Princeton recently. And my experience, and it's usually some of these old mainline churches that are making the critique that there's watered down theology in these megachurches. Well, at this old line, I mean, this couldn't be more mainstream Presbyterian church than you can get. There was no energy there. I just didn't feel it. And so I don't know. That's just kind of an observation I had.
Yeah, I think that much of the critique of any movement is you don't do it the way I want you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. Because new movements are always creating new things. What Leadership Network focuses on, well, the way we label it, is we focus on entrepreneurial innovators, people who are starting new things and doing new things. And our work tends to be with churches. So we look for churches that are starting new things and doing new things in a new way. So, having said that, America has been a great place for all types of innovation, including religious innovation. And this is one of the current expressions of that religious innovation, because we are very comfortable here in the United States of moving on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as new churches emerge, there'll be still yet behind us another generation of new churches, and they'll probably be large. I contend we'll still have mega churches as long as the society and the enablement factors are working in the favor of large churches and large gatherings. In America, I don't see that ending.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we have a few minutes left here on the podcast, and that's one of the things I want to get out of you is your prognostication of where things are going with this megachurch movement. There's a number of other myths you address in your book we haven't gotten to, and I am going to urge people to pick that up, and I'm also going to link to that article that you mentioned, Not Who They Think They Are, on our website. So our listeners should check that out, should check out your book, Beyond Megachurch Myths. But before we close up and think about the future here, there is one question for me that is rather intriguing, and this is when I interviewed Mark Driscoll, and when I think about Rick Warren and such, and a lot of these pastor-based churches. Now, again, you don't necessarily put them in the charismatic pastor category, but from the outside, a lot of people see this, and a lot of these mega churches have been pastor-driven. And since we've only seen the rapid growth of megachurches in the last three decades, we're really only experiencing the first generation of these pastors. So my big question is what happens when a Rick Warren passes from the scene, or Joel Osteen, or a Mark Driscoll, or Bill Hybels? What happens to their church when they're no longer the central figure? Do these things fade and shrivel, or what do you think is going to go on here?
Well, I'm going to give you a much longer answer than you want to hear.
Okay, that's fine.
But, I described the four different styles of churches, and succession and what success looks like in succession is really different in all four of those styles, and there are different approaches taken for each of those. And in fact, one of the things that I consult in with lots of churches is in the whole area of succession. And I will tell you that in the last 5 years, I've had incredible demand from leaders who are leading large churches, as we have begun to talk about what the succession plans look like and what does the leadership look like after they have moved from the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how it's all going to come out. I don't have any guarantees there. We have many large churches, especially in the seeker models and the program models, that have moved on quite successfully. We have many that have failed spectacularly in this kind of succession thing. What has changed slightly, Anthony, is the multi-site movement of megachurches has really altered the dynamics somewhat of succession. And I'll explain that for just a second. In the past, we tended to identify megachurches with one location and one kind of piece of property that they had built a monster structure on, let's say, and that And so it was all based on getting people to that site. But we've seen this amazing growth in the last decade of the multi-site movement, which has also sped up the number of megachurches. And now you can have a site that's in an area of a community that was growing 10 years ago, but now has slowed in its growth. But then they have a second location that's growing in a place a little further out and is sometimes a little younger, and another generation of people, which is keeping that church growing and dynamic. And whether in succession there will be, they will choose to have two pastors, one for this location, one for that location, one for still yet a third location, or whether they will change the structure totally is one of the open questions. And so, for example, a couple of the specific cases that you mentioned, I have spoken with those leaders about what they see for the future, and of course, they feel confident that they're going to be fine. I would say some of them are going to be fine, and some of them aren't. The choice of a leader, whether that's in a business, a university, principal of a school, is a vital and important choice always. And some leaders can live up to it, and some don't. The other thing that happens is, how do we define success after succession? If we define success as, well, the next leader will be just as prominent and the church will be just like it was when the first pastor or that other pastor was here, then we're kidding ourselves. Success will look different as a institution, as a congregation ages into its next generations. But we have come to expect, because of Pyrgon, and you mentioned it very early in the podcast, the model that most Americans have of a church is a community-based, small, 100 to 300-sized congregation that is going to be here forever. We're going to have a pastor for this 10 years, and then we're going to have another pastor, and I'm going to be here for maybe 20 or 30 years until I have to move closer to the kids or something like that. But that church will always be here. That's what we hold in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really the case, but that's what we hold in our heads.
That's kind of an interesting thing to note, that our religious landscape is constantly changing, and oftentimes we affiliate this religious landscape changing with decline, but it's really changing forms in ways that we don't see what is happening or see clearly what is going on here. So I think part of the benefit of your work with Beyond Megachurch Myths and your other articles and stuff is really you do make this very clear. In 1 or 2 minutes that you do at the end here, you belong to an organization called Leadership Network. If you could just fill us in briefly on what you do with that and what kind of services you provide for a lot of these different churches.
Yeah, I'm the managing director, so I do very little.
Oh, okay. But,
Leadership Network is a 27-year-old organization that was formed really to work with entrepreneurial innovators in a couple of fields, of which one of those fields is churches. And we, since it was formed 27 years ago, kind of the modern megachurch era was emerging at that time, and we kind of fell in with a bunch of leaders who were leading those institutions, and we developed our programs to serve, now in the United States, in Canada, and in Europe, the entrepreneurial innovative churches. And our methodology is primarily to gather leaders who are trying to do a number of innovations, to put them in small groups together, and we have a process by which we help them plan and coach and encourage them along. What we say is we help people go from ideas to implementation to impact, where they can double their results in half the time. And we've been able to do that with a number of different movements in a number of different areas in the United States, including the multi-site movement. When we started in that 10 years ago, now identifying the churches that were just emerging, that were trying that, there were about 100 multi-site churches in the United States, and now there's over 3,000. So that's our primary work. We're a donor-driven, donor-funded organization by about 25 families around the United States. And so that's what we do. What I do is I supervise a team of great professionals, directors, and coordinators that help make that stuff happen.
And you said you do more than churches?
We also have done a little work with other not-for-profits that are serving Christian goals and Christian aims. And so we do a little bit more than that. And then another part of our organization, our parent company is called 100X, our parent organization. And another part of our ministry is what we call halftime, which focuses on mid-career professionals that are what we say are moving from success to significance. And many of those are exiting the marketplace or re-envisioning what the second half of their life is going to look like as they seek to serve kingdom causes.
And that really has been spearheaded by Bob Buford, if I'm correct, right?
Our chairman of our board is Bob Buford of our parent organization. And Bob did write the book Halftime, but the man that runs our halftime ministry is named Dean DeWalmy.
Okay. I hear that word halftime and I hear leadership. I'm wondering if you guys provide consulting services for the Seattle Seahawks to help get our quarterback situation straightened up. I don't think you guys do that deal.
Yeah, and being an Atlanta Falcon fan, we would not want to help any other NFC team anyway.
All right. Well, anyways, Dave, it has been a pleasure having you on the program. We didn't cover all the things that I wanted to today with our megachurch miss. Maybe at some point in time we'll come back to you on some of these things. But in the meantime, people can pick up your book, Beyond Megachurch Miss. Visit the Leadership Network. Pick out the article, Not Who You Think They Are. We'll provide links to all those on our website. And Dave, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Thank you, Nancy. I've enjoyed it. Let's do it again.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.